The purpose of the book I've written on 1948 and the purpose of this tour is to try and elucidate a very complex situation, but it's mainly motivated by an outrage that I'm sure many of you share about the gap, the unacceptable gap between the realities on the ground, many of us know them in Israel and Palestine, and the way that these realities are being represented and reported in the mainstream media in the West in general, and in this country, and America, and in the United States in particular.
The book is The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. The author is Ilan Pappe, a Jewish Israeli-born academic, now a professor of history at the University of Exeter, UK. The largest meeting hall of the Vancouver Public Library was filled to capacity on March 29, 2008. The overflow crowd gathered in the doorway and up a staircase to hear the final speech of Ilan Pappe's book tour. To keep within the hour, we join the audience 10 minutes into the speech.
However, the moment the Zionist movement, or the leaders of the early Zionist movement, decided that the only place where they could satisfy the two impulses, the impulse for security and the impulse for self-determination, the moment they decided that the only space to do it is the land of Palestine, the Zionist movement became a colonialist project. And I think this is the first station in the history of the place that has to be revisited and which has relevance to the contemporary situation and to the future, and to future developments. We cannot ignore the fact that the Zionist movement was a colonialist movement, and that Zionism, among other things, is part of the history of colonialism. This is a fact that is totally ignored by anyone who was involved in the peace process ever since 1948 and until today. It totally misrepresents the Palestinian and Arab view on the question of Palestine. And only for that reason alone, it would have been important to rethink about Zionism as a colonialist movement. But it's even more than that. The whole idea that people who move from Europe to the heart of the Arab land cannot be regarded as colonialism in the 19th century is an impossible historical reality. However positive anyone would think Zionism is in any other respect. And the fact that Zionism as a colonialist project was never recognized as a historical fact disables, I think, the Arab world and the Palestinian to come to a closure with the Jewish community that now inhabits the land of Palestine and Israel. So we should face this first historical fact without feeling that by that we undermine anyone's right to be where they are, or that we are indulging in pejorative adjectives to demonize anyone, and we're not idealizing anyone else as well. We're just stating a simple historical fact that deserves our attention, and we understand, I think, from that if you want to bring peace and reconciliation to the land, you have to decolonize it as a precondition for moving ahead with the efforts of peace and reconciliation. When the early settlers came to Palestine, I think the leadership of that community was not preoccupied with the question of what would be the fate of the indigenous native population of Palestine. I would say that from the late 19th century until the mid-1930s, the leaders of the Zionist movement were busy with questions that one could best define as preparing the infrastructure for a future state. They were busy building independent, autonomous agencies, services. They were looking for ways of persuading Jews around the world to immigrate into Palestine. and they began to purchase land in order to establish colonies and settlements on them. Of course, all these activities indirectly affected the Palestinian people. But in the political thought of Zionism at that stage, the future of the Palestinians, or as it was called in the Zionist discourse, the Arab question, was not yet an important issue compared to other issues on the agenda. This has all changed in the 1930s, with the rise of Nazism and fascism in Europe, with the arrival of many more Jewish immigrants into the country, and when the Jews constituted one-third of the overall population in Palestine, the Zionist leadership began to contemplate seriously the fate of the Palestinians on the land of Palestine. I think also the fact that the Palestinians themselves, for the first time in their history, began to understand and absorb the significance of that colonialism also contributed to the urgency on the Zionist side to develop a strategy with regard to the indigenous native population of Palestine. And my main assertion when I visit this second station, the 1930s, in my historical journey is that the basic guidelines that informed the Zionist thought and strategy in the 1930s are still with us in the 21st century. Not much has changed in the basic Zionist and later on Israeli thinking about the role and future of the Palestinians who lived for centuries on the land of Palestine before the arrival of the first Jewish settlers. The Zionist leadership developed a two-dimensional vision about the question of Palestine. One dealt with the issue of space and geography, and the other one dealt with the issue of demography or population. And these two dimensions with regard to the Palestinians are still with us in the present political system in Israel. How much of the land of Palestine has to become Jewish so that the early Zionist ideals and objectives could be realized? And how many Palestinians can stay within that space as not to undermine the Zionist vision of having a safe Jewish haven on the land of Palestine? And already in the 1930s, very precise answers were given to these questions. And unfortunately, I don't think the answers in the 21st century are different from the answers given by the Zionist leaders in the 1930s. The answer to the first question, what should be the space, was that we should have as much of Palestine as possible. Preferably, the whole of Palestine. By the time that we are talking, the 1930s, people had a very clear geopolitical cartography of Palestine. They knew exactly what were the borders of Palestine. This is more or less Israel with the occupied territories today. So when the Zionist leaders drew imaginary or real maps of what should be the Jewish state, they wanted the whole of Palestine. They were willing to be satisfied with less of it if necessary. But basically, they were looking for historical opportunities to take it all. And this hasn't changed. In brackets, I would tell you that the peace process has been informed by the false assumption that there is a genuine Israeli desire to be content with 80% of Palestine. This is false, a false assumption, which created the false idea of the two-state solution, which produced the fiasco which is called the Oslo process, and which informs the discourse about peace still today, and doesn't allow us to move forward because we are all hooked on this idea that there is a genuine Israeli wish to depart with at least part of the land of Palestine. As to the second question, how many Palestinians can be on the whole of Palestine, the answer was also quite simple. If possible, not even one of them. If not possible, possible, they should be a very insignificant minority. Now, in the 1930s, this was a very bold assumption, because the Jews were only one-third of the population. Not only that, most of the Jews just came a few years earlier to the land. Imagine a group of immigrants who come to Canada. Maybe there is such a group, I don't know. Imagine a group of immigrants coming to Canada 3 years ago and saying, this is a beautiful land. We should have most of it, and we don't like the indigenous people who live here. And I'm not talking about the First Nations. I'm talking about everyone who's been here living until the last 3 years and saying, we should find the historical moment to get rid of them. If you understand that, I think you understand very well the history of Zionism. It took a while before these fluid and abstract ideas were translated into real strategies and plans. Because while thinking about the future of the space and the future of the people who lived on that space, Zionism was busy with other things. It developed a state, or an embryo state for the Jewish population, and it produced some miraculous achievements that I'm very much aware of as an Israeli Jew, and I never underestimate them. And I think they make the whole issue of the critique on Zionism so problematic, because if you put aside the question of how Zionism understood the role of Palestinians and how they envisaged Palestine as an Arab state, if you put that aside for a moment and you concentrate on Zionism as a national project for the Jewish people, it is an admirable project. Revival of a dormant language. I dream in a language that was dormant for 2,000 years. The creation of a vibrant, open society made out of more than 100 ethnic groups, and so on and so forth. And I think this contradiction between the miracle of creating a vibrant new state while colonizing another people and eventually dispossessing them explains the difficulties sometimes of dismantling the Zionist reality in a way that would be productive for creating a different reality in the future. In any case, in the last years of the British rule in Palestine, between 1946 to 1948, the Zionist leaders, and that's my third station in history, the Zionist leadership felt that it needs to move forward with the issue of taking over the land and getting rid of the people who live in it. And one of the important facts that informed the urgency was the inability to purchase land in Palestine. There was a great effort in the 1920s and the 1930s to buy land from absent Arab landowners. But in the end of the day, the Jewish agency, which represented the Zionist movement in Palestine, succeeded in only buying 7% of the land of Palestine and bringing over only 600,000 Jews that constituted only one-third of the population. So these two dimensions of space and demography were not satisfied by the natural development of the Jewish community in Palestine. So you needed a dramatic and drastic revolution in order that the space would become Jewish in the true meaning of the word, of having control over the space and having no Arabs in it. And it is within a year, between February 1947, which is the date when Britain decided to leave Palestine, and February 1948, when the actual ethnic cleansing of Palestine began, it is within a year that the Zionist leadership translated the abstract and fluid ideas of making Palestine a Jewish space, became that these ideas became real programs that would be executed on the ground. I chose to call this phase in which the Zionist leadership met almost weekly to discuss what would be done with the Palestinians in Palestine. I decided, after a lot of hesitation, to call it ethnic cleansing. Because ethnic cleansing is a very clear legal and moral concept. And by the time I wrote my book, there were already enough theoretical, legal, and political literature on what ethnic cleansing is all about. In fact, those of you who are interested can go, for instance, to the website of the American State Department, to its legal section. There is a very elaborate and very interesting exposure of what ethnic cleansing means in modern times. What ideology could justifiably call an ethnic cleansing ideology? What policy could be defined as an ethnic cleansing policy? And what I did, I actually decided to focus on this American definition and compare the evidence I had from Palestine against that model. And it fitted like a hand to a glove. The early thinking about it, the early strategies, and eventually the actual implementation of the plan. Ethnic cleansing is an ideology that is being implemented in a place where there are two ethnic groups, and one group wishes the disappearance of another group and decides that every means in its disposal is legitimate for achieving that role. And this is exactly the atmosphere in which the Zionist leaders met in between February 1947 and February 1948. They eventually decided, actually on the 10th of March 1948, that the time has come, before it would be too late, to begin and execute the plan on the ground. And then, in less than a year, in fact within 7 to 8 months, the Israeli army, the young Israeli army, went from one village to the other, from one urban neighborhood to the other, and dispossessed the people by force, demolished the houses, took over their assets, and completed the ethnic cleansing operation more or less in the winter of 1948-1949. It was quite a massive operation, if you think about it. Not only in absolute terms, because Palestine was and still is a small place compared to many other places in the world, but rather in relative terms. I think if you think about it in relative terms, you can understand the magnitude of the crime that Israel committed against the Palestinian people in 1947-1948. Imagine any other country in the world in which half of that country's population would be expelled by force within 7 or 8 months. And this is 3 years after the Holocaust. This is 3 years into the history of a Western civilization that seems to be much more sensitive than ever before to injustices in the name of colonialism and in the name of democracy or liberalism. Within that atmosphere, the Israelis managed to expel by force half of the country's population. Imagine any other country in the world in which within 7 months half of that country's villages would be destroyed and half of that country's towns would be demolished. Not to mention the, if you want, the quote-unquote more minor aspects of ethnic cleansing that accompany usually that act of destruction. The dispossession of people's property and land, the seizure of their real assets and their cultural assets. For me, and something I haven't written about in the book, it was too powerful for me, so I decided not to insert it into the book. But one of the most astonishing aspects of this pillage that followed the destruction was a delegation of professors from the Hebrew University that went from one house to the other to collect Arabic books for the Orientalist library of the Hebrew University. For me, as someone whose parents come from Germany, the picture, of course, is of the piles of books burned by the Germans. Now, of course, here, As one professor told me afterwards, what do you want? We didn't burn the books, we wanted to salvage them. And I think he believes it. I really think he believes it. And in a way, you can always say he's right, because, you know, if the books would stay in the house, an unlearned person would use it for something else. But that the overall moral obligation of a professor, a Jewish professor, to treat these books as the cultural property of another people has never occurred to me. More important, I think, historically, when we visit this station, is to remember how the world reacted to this destruction and pillage. Many people witnessed on the ground what I'm describing in my book and what I'm summarizing here. There were a lot of foreign reporters who went along the lines of the ethnic cleansing. There were quite a few emissaries of the Red Cross present, and quite a few representatives of the United Nations. And in fact, their reports from Palestine are a very important source for the historians for reconstructing what happened on the ground. But at the time, these reports were not published and not publicized. The headquarters of these organizations and agencies decided that it would be better not to attract attention that would force them to confront head-on the Zionist movement and later the State of Israel. Each for its own reasons. The editors of the newspapers in the West felt that they would criticize the Jewish people too soon after the Holocaust, and they didn't want to do that. So the reports were coming in to the editorial board of the New York Times, but the decision was not to publish them, or at least most of them. The International Red Cross had a big chip on its shoulders. It was ashamed and had a guilt complex because of the way it behaved during the Holocaust. As probably many of you would know, the Red Cross had visited the concentration camps and reported that these and accepted the Nazi narrative about them without any criticism. And the United Nations understood, but didn't want to confront, that its idea, which on the face of it looked like a reasonable idea, to divide Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state, that this idea had very little to do with the Zionist ambitions on the ground and with the reality that unfolded. And in many ways, what the United Nations Secretariat and leaders thought was a peace plan was actually a recipe for a disaster. The message that the world had sent to Israel in the end of 1948 was that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine was a domestic Israeli issue. That the young Jewish state is immune from any international criticism. As long as the perpetrators are Jews and the victims are Palestinians, the international public opinion represented at the time by the Western powers and the United Nations accepted as a necessary evil. And in this respect, I don't think much has changed. If you would apply international criteria of humanity, human rights and civil rights to the behavior of Israel in the occupied territories, most decent people around the world would find themselves at the forefront of demonstrations and actions against the State of Israel. But the same people who would go and demonstrate against the Chinese policy in Tibet or the Sudanese policy in Darfur, who in the past were among the pioneers in the movement for civil rights in the United States or against the war in Vietnam or the Pinochet regime in Chile, all these good people employing all these noble criteria of protesting against injustice are not to be found when it comes to examining and reacting to the realities on the ground in Israel and Palestine. It's a kind of a conspiracy of silence that developed in 1948, and I think most of us find it very difficult to liberate ourselves from that conspiracy of silence. We report to ourselves and to others only what we want to report, and we portray a picture that does not allow us to see who is the occupier and who is the occupied, who is the colonizer and who is the colonized, and who is the expeller and who are the expelled. And I think that this message from the world to the young state of Israel explains better than any other factor the development of Israeli policy ever since 1948, and in particular the kind of strategy that the consensus political system in Israel developed towards the occupied territories ever since 1967. The ethnic cleansing, in a way, continued until 1956. 36 Palestinian villages were depopulated between 1948 to 1956. Then there was a lull, in a way, caused mainly by the shock in Israel from what was called the Kfar Qasem massacre, where Palestinian citizens inside Israel were massacred by the Israeli border police, and this led at least some members of the political elite to ask for a lull in the both the dispossession of the Palestinians inside Israel, and there was a short-lived search for another policy, but it didn't last for long. And then came 1967. Now, if you remember the two basic dimensions of Zionist strategy towards the issue of Palestine and the Palestinians, you can understand how problematic and both exciting the new reality of 1967 was for the consensual Israeli political system or elite. I'm working now on a new book that looks at the Israeli debates in the early years of the occupation, especially the governmental debates, which are quite accessible to the historians nowadays. And it's an intriguing history, an intriguing chapter in the kind of history that I'm trying to reconstruct and recap for you tonight. The Israeli government between 1967 and 1968 was a unique government. It was a unity government that represented almost every faction in the Zionist political spectrum, from Menachem Begin in the right to Mapam in the left. We never had afterwards such a representative government of the basic Zionist ideologies with all their innuendos and divergence of opinions. And these politicians were faced with the dilemma that the 1967 war produced. Regardless of what we think are the causes of the war, this is a topic for another lecture. I'm much more interested of how they dealt with the realities that the war produced, which is far more relevant, I think, to what goes on today. On the one hand, if you take the dimension of space or geography, this was a jubilant historical moment. For the first time, 100% of the land was in the hands of the Jewish people, as they would put it, or in the hands of Israel. It was much better than 1948, as many of the Israeli military men who participated as high officers or senior officers in 1948 commended in 1967. This was a rectification of the mistake of 1948. Finally, we found the historical moment to compensate for the mistake we had done in 1948. The reason, by the way, that Israel did not occupy the West Bank in 1948 was not that it didn't have the military ability to do it. They had a prior agreement with Transjordan that in return for the annexation of the West Bank to Jordan, the Jordanian army would confine its operations in the 48 war to the area of Jerusalem, which they kept. They kept that promise. But there was a feeling among many Israeli politicians that this mistake was corrected in 1967.
You are listening to Alain Pappé, author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine.
However, on the other dimension, the dimension of demography and population, there was a problem. Yes, there is 100% of the land, but after getting rid of 1 million Palestinians, we now incorporated another 2 million. What can we do with that? That's an impossible reality. The war was very short. It was 6 days, as you know. And although the Israelis did expel a large number of Palestinians from the West Bank during the war, about 150,000 to 200,000, which became the new Palestinian refugees, the vast majority of the Palestinians were still there when hostilities came to an end and were now Israel's problem, so to speak. And the debate, as well as the decisions were taken by the Israeli government between 1967 and 1968, illuminate, I think, for us the result of the world's silence, what I call the conspiracy of silence of 1948, how it impacted the Israeli thinking in 1967. The Israeli government took three major decisions in 1967 that are with us still today. The first decision was that they cannot repeat what they had done in 1948. Not that there were not, there were members of the cabinet that actually offered, despite the fact that the war was over, to do what had been done in 1948, namely systematically expel the Palestinians from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. But the vast majority of the ministers said, you know, it's a different world, we cannot do it. What they did decide, by the way, but did not implement, was to move most of the people in Gaza to the West Bank. They thought that would be a more manageable society to control, but they didn't find the resources later on to implement it. The second decision was that the West Bank, and to a lesser extent the Gaza Strip, but mainly the West Bank, was part of Israel. The question was, how can we keep the West Bank without keeping the West Bankers in it, given the fact that we are not going to expel them? This was the real dilemma, and they had a very serious discussion about it. And two figures, in many ways from the 1948 generation, dominated the scene or gave the answer to the more confused politicians of how to do that. These were Moshe Dayan and Yigal Alon. They said, if we will keep remembering two things, they said. One is that there is no hurry. That we can keep the land and the people without making any major decisions about their fate. What we have to do is manage their lives through a military regime, as we did to the Palestinians in Israel under 1966. Second thing that we should remember is that we should find a way by which we sell to the world the idea that the West Bank is negotiable, that we are interested in peace. In fact, we should initiate peace. We should keep talking about peace. And we should never disclose the fact that actually all of us in this room, as Levi Eshkol, the Prime Minister, said, as all of us feel that this is ours, and nobody has the right to tell us to give it, and there's no one to give it to anyway. The third decision was to run the affairs of the Palestinians until that moment that a more decisive resolution would be taken, It's something that I think I would call correctly, although it doesn't, I'm not using the term that they were using, but this is my understanding as an historian. They would run the place as a mega prison with two models in mind. One is the mega open prison and one is the mega highly secured prison. The mega open prison is a prison where the Palestinians have a lot of privileges and rights as long as they don't challenge the basic Israeli control of the place. They can run their own life, they can run their municipalities, they can decide themselves what kind of a school system they want. If you want, domestic affairs can be totally in their hands, but they have no right whatsoever in determining their political future. Definitely they have no say in questions of security and of foreign affairs. If they would accept this model, then their autonomy would be quite extensive. And this form of generosity repeated itself in various stations from 1967 until today. The last generous Israeli offer of that kind was given to Yasser Arafat in the summer of 2000. The idea that the Palestinians can almost run the place as a state, almost as a state, provided they would secure in the hands of Israel their political future, their military future, and they would accept that the Jordan River is actually the border of Israel, the natural border of Israel. The other model of the prison is that should the Palestinian resist this idea, the open prison would turn into a highly secured prison, where the wardens would be allowed to use collective punitive disciplinary measures to keep them in place. And this cruel and callous formula, as you know, developed year by year. On the one hand, you had Palestinians' resistance to this reality, and on the other hand, you had an Israeli reaction to this Palestinian resistance. And the reaction was harsh, and then the Palestinian resistance became harsher, and then the reaction became even harsher. And the inventive mind of the wardens, if you want, of the prison, was endless. They found various ways of trying to send the message to the Palestinians that any individual act would immediately be met by collective punishment. But there was more to life under occupation, as you know, than just these two mega prison ideas. Two additional elements were decided upon already then in June 1967. One is that quite a few of the areas of the West Bank are not part of the mega prison. There should be directly annexed to Israel. There were two ways of annexing areas in the Palestinian territories to Israel. One was direct annexation, as had been done in the Greater Jerusalem area, an ever-expanding concept. I mean, I've never seen such a dynamic municipality as the Greater Jerusalem area. Now, you have to be careful in Vancouver, it may swallow you one day, because every day I hear of another part of the West Bank which is part of the Greater Jerusalem area, so that Israel, the consensus Israel would say, we're not negotiating Greater Jerusalem. So they're expanding it all the time. It already, I think, reaches my hometown in Haifa almost. The other way of creating annexation is by allowing Jewish settlements. This creates a no-go area for Palestinians within the Palestinian areas. Imagine a big prison, and then part of the prison are taken by the wardens, and the prisoners are not allowed to go into it, because that's an ex-territory that belongs to someone else. And what I'm trying to impress upon you, that these were decisions taken already in 1967. So the whole charade of an Israeli society tormented between a group of people that want to give back the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians and allow them to create an independent state, and a group of annexationist Israelis who do not wish to have any peace with the Palestinians is a fable, is a fabricated narrative. There isn't a genuine debate in Israel about Palestinian nationhood or independence or self-determination. There isn't. There is only a tactical debate on two issues. One is how best to sell to the world the Israeli, the old Zionist wish to have all of Palestine or most of Palestine with as few Palestinians as possible. So that's one debate. What is the best way of doing it? Should we have someone like Feiglin, who is about to visit you in Canada, and who would say to you forward, not one Arab should stay there, and we should have all the territory? Or should we have someone nice like Amos Oz or Abi Yoshua, who would tell us that they are tormented, and they would, and they're not sure that they want the whole territory, and there's a little settler in every Israeli Jew, and you have to understand it? And I don't want to. I mean, they do it much better than I do. But it's a tactical debate. This is not a genuine debate between one set of values and another set of values. Within the framework of Zionism, you can not, instead of having rainbows and fans, you have pyjama stripes. The Israeli political debate is that narrow. But they have an amazing ability of presenting it to all of us. It's a wide rainbow of ideas. So the first debate is tactical. The second debate is no less important, is the debate about the means of achieving it. Not just how to represent it, but how to do it. How to do it. And the debate of how to do it does not deviate from the basic ethnic conviction that it is totally legitimate and there is no moral problem with a constant open discussion in Israel about what is called the demographic problem. Namely, how many Palestinians can live in a Jewish space. Imagine students, as in my university, former university in Haifa, who sit in the class of a professor called Arnon Sofer, professor of geography. And usually his classes, like all our classes in Haifa, have a large number of Palestinian students in them. Imagine them sitting there and hearing this professor explaining to them that the national security of Israel depends on how many siblings each of their family would have. And if they would have too many children, this is a threat to the national security of Israel. I once asked him, what would you do if you would hear someone in Canada say the same thing about the Jewish citizens of this country? He said, you cannot compare. These are Arabs and these are Jews. These kinds of debates, which seem to an Israeli a very noble debate, are the ones that inform the real discussion in Israel about the fate of the occupied territory. But they are not at all represented in the way that the internal Israeli debate is being commodified and sold to the wider world. So at the end of my talk, I would try and suggest how to get out of it, because I really think that the few stations I visited tonight, the station of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, or beginning with the era of direct colonialism before that, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and the very decisive moment when the Israeli political elite made its mind that the occupied Palestinian territories would never be given up and would form part of the state of Israel, while still looking for a future for those Palestinians living in it. I really believe that all these three stations, these three major stations, explain to us why the peace process that bypassed them is not moving anywhere. Because any talk about two-state solution, any talk about a generous Israeli proposal that is not being reciprocated by inflexible, intransigent Palestinian leaders, only validates the Israeli determination to continue with the formula that they have developed in 1948 and still continue to develop in 2008. This allows them to decide, as they have decided in 2000, to divide the West Bank into two parts. One part that they are going to annex, actually they are annexing as we speak, to Israel. And the other, and from any part they annex, they would eventually cleanse the Palestinians. There's no doubt about it. They would find a way of expelling the Palestinians from any part of the West Bank that they would now annex to Israel. And keeping the rest of the Palestinians in the West Bank in a mega prison that would be subjected to punitive action should it resist the idea of the partition of the West Bank to two parts. And look what happened in the Gaza Strip. The second mega prison surprised the Israelis. The inmates launched missiles against the wardens and the prison authorities. This is something the Israelis cannot tolerate. And therefore the punitive action there are much harsher and more callous than they are in the West Bank. They decided to react to any launch of missiles or any reaction that comes from the Gaza Strip with F-16s and tanks. So it translates, if you accumulate it, it translates into massive killing policy, into genocidal policies. Not because the Israelis want to genocide Palestinians, but because the model that they have built of a mega prison didn't have this dynamic of the prison rebelling as a whole, or having a leadership that says, no way, we don't accept it. You cannot tell the world that because you've taken the settlers out and you have encircled us and you starve us and you strangulate us, you cannot tell us that this is peace. And you were great people, you disengaged, you withdrew, you made the first step towards peace to the point that Ariel Sharon was considered seriously as a candidate for Nobel Prize in Oslo. You can feel how it would drive mad anyone in Gaza that this would be celebrated as a peaceful Israel. I mean, I remember the demonstration in Tel Aviv of Peace Now, calling on Sharon to complete the disengagement from Gaza, as if a new era of peace began. Whereas everyone with his eyes in his head understood that Sharon realized that you cannot keep the warden within the prison community, you have to take them out. Otherwise they would be in danger for their life. That's the only thing Sharon did in Gaza. But the PR machinery, of course, celebrated it as another thing. And the result is, of course, that since the people who rebel in Gaza also have beards and look very much like Muslims, that the Israelis even feel that they have even more of a free license to use the most evil kind of, and lethal, not evil, I'm sorry, the most lethal weapons in their arsenal in order to quell the rebellion as they would see it. This is where we are today. This is the reality. It's not the reality of peace. And I think that the way out of it, the way of integrating the historical narrative into the political action of the future, and with this I would come to close here, to closure, is that it's not enough to disseminate the kind of narrative I'm trying to present to you tonight, and challenge the narrative which is hegemonic in the media, in the academia, and in the political system. Of course, this is part of the story. We have to make sure that people know that story. But I think far more important than that, in order to make this narrative stick, in order to include this narrative in the political analysis of the contemporary reality, is to try and convince people to change the dictionary. We are all recipients of the big Israeli launderette of words. They are masters of it. It's amazing how assassinations are targeted killings and expulsions are relocations. They have an amazing group of people that succeed in presenting the reality exactly the opposite from what it is. But we have to start using different words, different nouns, different phrases, in order to get ourselves and others used to a tool of language that would help us to see the reality for what it is, and not to buy anymore the false reality that is being sold to us, and which creates this impossible gap of which I talked in the beginning of my lecture, between the representation and the evidence on the ground. One of the first concepts or words I would like to get rid of, and I'm trying to train myself to do this, is the word conflict. There is no conflict between Israel and Palestine. There is no conflict between occupier and occupied, between colonizer and colonized, between an expeller and expelled. Conflict gives with it, or creates with it, the impression of parity, of equality. People are equally to be blamed. People are equally guilty in their violent reactions, in their lack of progress towards peace, and you start to make everything visible also divisible. That's where the language of partition is far more beyond geography. The language of partition makes it very easy for the people who perpetrate the crime to become victims, very much like the Austrians succeeded for so many years to portray themselves as the first victims of Nazism, whereas they were the greatest associates of the Nazis. We have to change that language of conflict. And without deteriorating into satanic demonization of anyone, just call the actions on the ground the way they are. When someone occupies, it's an occupation. And then you can explain to people what occupation means. You don't have to use conflict. It doesn't explain anything about occupation. There may be conflict in the municipality of Vancouver about the future ecological policy. But there's no, I don't know, I hope, there's no occupation in Vancouver. You don't have a military sergeant who can go through the shopping mall here and destroy every shop whenever he would feel like it. This is occupation. You cannot have in Vancouver a military person going through a school and decide that it's high time to close the school because he didn't like the look on the face of a student that he passed by. This is occupation. This is not a conflict. And you can't see in Vancouver a situation where a military officer would come to a house and would give the people who live in that house 5 minutes to leave it and never come back to it because they need the house for military purposes or they suspect that in the house there is someone they don't like or whatever reason. Imagine a system, a lawless system, where the people who represent law and order actually are absolute controller of your life. And usually they are young soldiers who can do it. In every given moment, at every given aspect of your life, you are at the mercy of people who have guns in their hands. This is a conflict. This is not a conflict. So we should start talking about occupation, dispossession, demolition of houses, collective punishment, curfews, apartheid roads only for Jews, apartheid walls that segregate people from their lands, people from their families, from their businesses. This is not conflict. I never heard anyone at any given moment in the history of apartheid South Africa calling it a conflict. There was no conflict in South Africa. There was apartheid. And what Israel has in the occupied territories is far worse than apartheid. The second term, and this is more to my Palestinian friends, I think they made a mistake, which I know where it comes from, but I think it was a great mistake to call the events of 1948 Nakba, a catastrophe. Catastrophe can be a natural catastrophe. There's no one to be blamed when there is a catastrophe. Everybody suffers from catastrophe. The Palestinians for so many years was in love with this term and never understood the passivity that comes with this term. It was a beautiful term as far as the Israelis were concerned. In fact, many Israelis on the right wing, I can show you Israeli historians on the right wing, who adopted the term Nakba. They like it. They say, yes, there was a catastrophe for the Palestinians. Terrible things, really. Who caused it? Well, you know, global warming maybe, I don't know. Nobody is responsible for catastrophes. This is the reason I decided after many hesitations to use the term ethnic cleansing. Because ethnic cleansing is not a catastrophe. It's a human crime. In fact, it is defined as a crime against humanity. And when you have a crime, you have criminals. And when you have a crime, you have a way of solving the crime. And I think if we will use these terms more openly, and we train ourselves to use them more openly, we would be able to defeat all these accusations that are directed against those of us who support the Palestinian cause, and quite often we fall into the trap. The accusations of anti-Semitism or self-hating Jews or people who don't believe in the right of Israel to exist, all the things that usually stifle the debate and silence us on the spot. Most of us, I know, it works. We would be able, I think, to resist it if you would tell people, if I object to the demolition of houses, to the slaughter of children, I am an anti-Semite. If this is your definition of anti-Semitism, go to the Webster Dictionary and please change the definition of anti-Semitism. An anti-Semite is someone who objects to the demolition of houses. An anti-Semite is someone who objects to the expulsion of people. And an anti-Semite is someone dangerous who wants to see a democratic, equitable system at work in Israel and Palestine. If this is anti-Semitism, I'm happy to be called an anti-Semite. And finally, so that there's enough time for discussion, I think that we have to find a way of coming to terms with the fact that everyone, whoever he or she is entitled to take a moral position on the question of Palestine that stems from a universal human rights and civil rights. As I said to many friends in this tour, I have a lot of sympathy to the people of Tibet. And I understand very much the support that they are being given. But I was amazed and bewildered, I must say. I read the newspapers and the many flights that I was subjected to take. And I didn't realize how vast this country is when I said that. I do a Canadian tour in 5 days. So my wife said to me, "You were never very good at geography. You think this is Switzerland, you can do it." Never mind. Because I had a lot of time to read the press here. And it seems that the core of the solidarity with the Tibetan people, again, with whom I have a lot of sympathy, was the human rights violation. And rightly so. And I was looking for the evidence. I mean, what does the Canadian press bring to you as readers, as viewers, as listeners, as the ultimate proof that the rights of the Tibetan people are being violated? You know what it is? That there are many political prisoners. That the Chinese are imprisoning people in Tibet without trial. How many? Few hundreds. There are 10,000 political prisoners in Palestine as we talk. Half of them are children. Nobody disrupts a ceremony that Israel is involved in. I'm sure that the municipality of Vancouver, like all the other Canadian cities, would celebrate Israel's 60th anniversary and would mention these 10,000 political prisoners. But imagine what kind of a PR one side has that few hundreds political prisoners endanger the future of the Olympic Games and the 40 years with its thousands and thousands of political prisoners does not get into even page number 10 in your local newspapers and TV channels and radio stations. This is something and I do hope that we will all have the energy and the ability at least to allow the normal human instinct and impulse to oppose injustice wherever it is and whoever we are, to allow this natural instinct to work in the case of Palestine. That's all what we need. You don't need to be an elaborate student of that place. You don't have to be a special pious person. All you have to do is allow a very natural instinct, because we are all good human beings. And believe me, even if you would allow it to the Israelis, even the Israelis would be there. There are no evil people, but there are evil systems, and we should challenge them with all our force. Thank you.
That was Professor Ilan Pappe, spelled P-A-P-P-E, a professor of history at the University of Exeter, UK. Dr. Pappe is one of the few Jewish academics to speak out about the treatment of the Palestinians. His visit was organized by the Canada-Palestine Support Network at www.canpalnet.ca.